From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Early last month, retired Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson joined us on the program. He has a 31-year service career, including as Chief of Staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell, and also when Powell was Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Today, Wilkerson is a professor of government and public policy at the College of William and Mary. Now, last month, he revealed that he's part of two groups devoted to protecting the November elections, the National Task Force on Election Crises and the Transition Integrity Project. Now, he said a lot that day that caught my attention. For example, I asked Wilkerson, who are the people in your group who seriously worry that the president would use the U.S. military to interfere with a U.S. election? And he said,
you might be stunned if I were able to give you some of the names. Let's just say that it's people who've been in the national security establishment, some of them 30, 40 years, people who served in cabinet positions as secretaries for various presidents, people of both political parties and people who are independents, people who work in the precincts with state secretaries of state and voting officials throughout Michigan, Pennsylvania, Florida, Texas, and so forth.
Well, for the rest of June and into early July, members of these groups didn't say much. But in recent days, the Transition Integrity Project in particular has been more public about its work and about its concerns about what might happen after November 3rd. No small coincidence, by the way, that Election Day is less than 100 days away. So this hour, Colonel Wilkerson agreed to come back on the show to talk more about the Transition Integrity Project, and he joins us from Falls Church, Virginia. Colonel Wilkerson, welcome back to the program.
Good to be with you, Meghna. Thank you for having me.
We also today have the co-founder of the Transition Integrity Project, Rosa Brooks. She is a professor of constitutional and international law and national security at the Georgetown School of Law, also a former official in the Defense Department. Professor Brooks, welcome to you.
Thank you, Meghna.
Okay, so first of all, Professor Brooks, I'd actually like to spend a couple of minutes with you. You co-founded the Transition Integrity Project. First of all, when did you co-found it and why? What was going through your mind when you decided you wanted to get together a bipartisan group like this?
You know, I think a lot of people have been wondering in the back of their minds for a few years now, you know, what would Donald Trump do if he lost? Would he leave? Or is he the kind of guy who would say, the election was stolen, I actually won, it's fake news that I lost, I'm staying? And the seeds for the Transition Integrity Project were planted back last autumn. I was at a big dinner, one of those big DC dinners, and I was chatting with a federal appellate court judge and a guy who was a corporate counsel at a big corporation, and I said, idly, you know, as one does, I said, wow, what if Trump lost but wouldn't leave? And the federal judge said immediately, oh, no, that would never happen. The military would never let that happen. And the other guy said, oh, no, that would never happen. The Secret Service would never let that happen. And I thought, wait, what? You know, what do you mean the military would never let that happen? What do you mean by the military? What do you mean wouldn't let that happen? I had this sort of image of, you know, you think the Joint Chiefs of Staff are going to march across the Potomac from the Pentagon, you know, carrying a bunch of bazookas and head to the White House? Because I can't see that happening. And if it happened, it wouldn't really be a good thing. And the same for the Secret Service. You know, who exactly are we talking about? What mechanisms, what institutional mechanisms? And this conversation sort of left me thinking, I think a lot of people have this false sense of security, that there exists some magic institution that in the event of President Trump doing something in defiance of the law, in defiance of democratic rule of law norms, would just kind of descend like the gods and rescue America. But that's not really how people and institutions work. So the impetus for creating this project was to really find a way to talk in a more granular way about the what ifs, you know, what would happen and what would these actors do, with a view, obviously, not just towards scaring the heck out of everybody, which I think we are succeeding in doing, unfortunately, but you know, primarily with a view towards figuring out how do we make those scary realities not come true? You know, what can be done right between now and November to make sure that America stays the America we want it to be, or and becomes the America we want it to be?
Mm. Okay, so we're going to dig into some of the what ifs as much as you can, both you and Colonel Wilkerson can tell us here in a few minutes. But you gathered a bipartisan group of folks across different sectors, right? I mean, can you tell us who you reached out to come together to go to sort of game through these scenarios?
Happy to, and I can give you some names. We're actually in the process of going back to all of our participants and saying, are you willing to have your name publicly connected to this? We had promised everybody, you know, we'll keep your participation confidential if you would like us to. But a lot of people are beginning to say, I'm happy to be publicly connected to it. So they ranged from people like the Michael Steele, the former chairman of the Republican National Committee, to John Podesta, who obviously worked worked for Hillary Clinton, very senior levels, Obama, et cetera. They brought together and Larry, you know, people like Larry, with deep experience, obviously not only in the military, but Larry also has deep experience at the State Department, and I'll let him talk about that. We had former governor Jennifer Granholm, from Michigan. We had Donna Brazile as a Democratic consultant. We had Republican political consultants and even a couple of former Republican members of Congress, some of whose names are not yet out there. So it was a very varied group. We had people who had worked for members of Congress at senior levels. We had people who had been members of Congress from both parties. We had journalists. We had people like Bill Kristol on the conservative side, as well as people who had worked for big tech companies. So we really were trying as much as we could to assemble a group of people who, if asked to role play, if asked, okay, pretend you're on the Trump campaign, pretend that you're a Democratic elected official, pretend that you are, you know, Facebook or Twitter. We wanted people who would have a real life sense of how those actors and organizations likely would behave based on actual experience in those sectors.
So people with deep experience, people who had been at the highest levels of the organizations and parts of the government that that are on their resumes. I mean, it's kind of a from what you can tell us so far, Professor Brooks, it's kind of a who's who in terms of the American leadership firmament. So, Colonel Wilkerson, let me turn to you. So, first of all, I mean, I think that is it a safe presumption to say that everybody involved in this group actually felt like this was a worthwhile exercise to think through what might happen if there are disputed results from the election in November? I think just that fact in and of itself is quite arresting, if I can put it that way. Is there that much concern amongst the people that you know, Colonel?
I believe so. And let me just echo what Rosa said and tell you that when I've met the first time with the group, I believe it was in December of last year, I looked around the room and I said, my goodness, how many 800-pound gorillas are in this room? How will we ever forge any kind of consensus? And under Rosa's leadership, I think we have done so, which is a remarkable feat. But the answer to your question is yes, people to varying degrees believe this could be the most serious election in America's history.
And so then you came together, and so when or did Professor Brooks first, when she first approached you, did you say, yeah, let's do this, but, you know, to what end?
Well, I came to it with a bit of skepticism, but you have to remember, too, since June of last year, I've been a member of the National Task Force on Election Crises, and the very first meeting we had, sitting around the room with some of the most prestigious representatives of some of the most prestigious law firms in the United States and others, I was already cognizant of the fact that there was deep concern, profound concern, at least among the elite in America, that we were headed for some troubled times and maybe even crisis times. And so when I came into the Transition Integrity Project, I was already very much a part of that warp and woof, if you will, of concern in America.
Well, Professor Brooks, let me turn back to you. A little bit later in the show, I'm going to ask both you and the Colonel to walk us through one of these sort of tabletop exercises that you went through in detail. But in the minute or so that we have before the break, let me just say that there are probably ardent supporters of the president, and certainly the president himself, who upon hearing the existence of a group like the Transition Integrity Project would say, first of all, they're hyperventilating over nothing. And second of all, this is deep state stuff. I mean, what's your response? And I don't say that jokingly. Like, what's your response to that? Those concerns, allegations?
I think there's nothing particularly deep state-ish about it. I think every citizen of the United States is having a lot of the same anxieties. And we're a nonpartisan group. You know, we don't take a position on who Americans should vote for or will vote for, and either major party candidate could win completely legitimately. But we think this election has more risks and everybody needs to be thinking about what they are.
Well, we are talking this hour with Professor Rosa Brooks. She's co-founder of the Transition Integrity Project. Retired Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson joins us as well. He's a member of this group. And when we come back, we'll talk more about these war games or tabletop exercises they did, thinking through what might happen if there isn't a smooth election night and what could happen in the 11 weeks between November 3rd and January 2021. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we are talking with members of a group called the Transition Integrity Project. It's a group of former high-level members of the United States government across various sectors, including the military, who have met quietly to think through what might happen in the event of a contested election in the United States on November 3rd. Rosa Brooks joins us. She's a professor of constitutional and international law and national security at the Georgetown School of Law, former Defense Department official as well. She co-founded the Transition Integrity Project. And retired Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson joins us as well. He is a distinguished adjunct professor of government and public policy at the College of William and Mary, served for 31 years in the United States Army, including and also served as chief of staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell as well, when Powell was at State and at the Joint Chiefs as well. So, Professor Brooks and Colonel Wilkerson, I'd like to actually go into some detail into what these sort of strategic exercises that you did, these tabletop exercises you did with this group of about 80 folks in the Transition Integrity Project. So first of all, Professor Brooks, just define us. I mean, when people think of, you know, war games, quote unquote war games, it's usually thought of in the military or national security context. So broadly speaking, what is a war game or a tabletop exercise supposed to accomplish?
Well, they're widely used in the national security world, but they're also increasingly used in the private sector and in other areas of government and the nonprofit sector, because basically it's just a way to think through some what ifs. That's a little bit more structured and a little bit more disciplined than just sitting around together saying, hey, what if this bad thing happens? What if that happens? What do we do? The idea is that you don't get to say, oh, that could never happen, that you actually have to think about the things that probably won't happen, that you hope won't happen, but think about, well, could they happen and how could they happen? And if they happened, what would we do? Not because you're predicting an outcome, but because you want to be prepared and in fact, you want to prevent the bad outcomes from ever coming mm-hmm. about. So they can be structured in all kinds of different ways. And my guess is that Larry has been part of many, many, many more of them in his career than I have been. But what we did, and I should emphasize, by the way, this was not just former government folks. This was also media, private sector people participating, because we really wanted to have as wide a range of backgrounds and expertise as we could, polling experts and so forth. And we used a form of gaming called a matrix game, which essentially you start with a scenario, you know, the scenario, Trump loses the popular vote, but wins in the Electoral College, or Biden has a narrow win in the Electoral College and a larger win in the popular vote, or whatever it may be. And you know, we worked with experts on polling and election law to try to come up with scenarios that state by state that were as realistic as possible. And you then take your participants and we assign them into teams. So we had a team playing the role of the Trump campaign. We had a team playing the role of the Biden campaign. We had teams playing elected officials from each party. We had a media team. We had a sort of public team with some polling experts who could help say, you know, here's how people might respond in this situation or that situation. And then each team gets to make moves, and the moves take the form of essentially saying, okay, hello, we're the Trump campaign. We're going to do X in order to accomplish Y, and we believe it's going to be successful because Z. And that move might be we're gonna request a recount, or we're gonna file a lawsuit requesting, you know, a halt to the vote counting in Michigan or wherever. Think it's, you know, that will help us because here's what we're gonna try to accomplish with this, and here's why we think it's gonna work. And then the other players can weigh in and say things like, not in role at that moment, but based on their real life experience, and say, yeah, that's probably going to be successful, or no, you know, that's a total long shot, or who knows, 50-50. Based on that, we actually, you know, these games are quite artificial. They have all kinds of constraints. That's one of the reasons to emphasize they're not predictions. They're explorations of possibilities, not this is what's going to happen. But then there's an element of pure randomness. We literally had our guy running the games, an expert on game design, would roll a 10-sided die. And depending on the comments from participants, the probability of success of a particular move might be judged to be 20% or 80% or 50-50. And depending on that initial assessment, the die would be rolled to determine, okay, it worked. You know, the court ruled in your favor, or the recount was stopped, or it didn't work. And then other players sequentially would be able to make moves in response. And this would go on through several phases, with different teams making moves and the other teams responding to them, in an effort as much as we could to, you know, in a period of 4 or 5 hours, to simulate what would take place in the real world over weeks, and in fact a couple of months, in an effort to try to figure out, if that happened, what in fact would these other actors do? What would career civil servants do? What would the military do? What would elected officials do?
Right. So just to get it out of my system, I have to say, for every child who ever played Dungeons and Dragons, look, it could actually end up being something as useful as playing through scenarios regarding election security in the United States. But I say that jokingly, but in all seriousness, there's a point to these kinds of exercises. And Colonel Wilkerson, let me turn to you. Can you tell us? I understand that this was all done under Chatham House rules, so there may be limits to what you can say, but I'd love to hear in as much detail as you can offer sort of what happened on a team that you played in one of these scenarios, and you know, sort of like, how did the game evolve, and how did the tabletop exercise evolve? Where did it end up in terms of gaming through a possible scenario for November 3rd?
Well, remember now, I was an observer, so I'm very quiet. I don't say anything, and I just watch what everyone does. And by the way, I do this at William & Mary. I've run over 40 simulations with my students, and what you gain from these things is insights as much as anything else. My students, for example, last semester handled the COVID-19 pandemic, and I have to say did a better job than the current administration. They did a marvelous job, even to the point where they classified and predicted under the classification, very high classification, that the market might become more important than people's lives. And so they actually had a very intense and passionate debate over that, from which I gained some insights that are now being revealed for me in the real world. What came out of these things, for example, vividly, and this is a blinding flash of the obvious, but it's very important because sometimes these kind of blinding flashes are not so obvious as you think, is how powerful, how utterly powerful the incumbent is. The person who owns the government owns the military, Homeland Security, the State Department, you name it. If there is a deep state, he owns it. And what results from that is enormous power, particularly when the Constitution is so ambiguous about many of the aspects of elections and the states handle everything. We're seeing a display of some of that power right now as the president, and I think the attorney general is orchestrating some of this, deploys forces, law enforcement forces, ostensibly to various cities around the country. This is a foreshadowing, perhaps, of something that might happen in November. This came out of an insight I gained from one of the tabletops. So when you go through these things, you're not learning lessons. You're not necessarily able afterwards to develop critical thinking about how you might respond to it, though those are often offshoots. What you're gaining is insights into decision-making and how things might play out. John Maynard Keynes once said that the greatest variable in the world, and thus a very powerful element, is uncertainty. Well, that is the most powerful variable right now with regard to November, uncertainty. And I might add, too, it's also the most powerful variable with regard to the economy and where the economy might go. So we're looking at some real dangerous times right now in a number of different senses. And these tabletops highlight to a certain extent how people might react to some of these dangerous times.
Yeah. Well, Professor Brooks, can you talk more about that? Because I'm seeing here to Colonel Wilkerson's point about how, in fact, instability further cements the power of the incumbent. That at least in some of the scenarios, what gamed out was that there were demonstrations in the streets and demands for recounts in various states, lots of legal challenges. I mean, all of this actually seems entirely plausible to me. But as the game played out, as the tabletop played out, those things contributed to the president in this tabletop exercise coming across more as the candidate of stability, quote unquote.
Oh, well, certainly that was how the Trump team tried to spin it. But I think one of the things that the exercises illustrated, which again, I think we already know, it just made it even more kind of painfully, crushingly clear, is sort of the war over narrative in this country is very bitter and likely to be an enormous part of what happens in the period immediately leading up to and after Election Day, that in all of our scenarios, we had efforts by the supporters of President Trump to, even in the scenarios where we had framed it as Vice President Biden has clearly won the majority of the ballots cast and won in the Electoral College, to frame it as that's not true, fake news, it's being stolen, it's a coup. And to use social media channels, to use the powers of the executive to put that narrative out there. And clearly there is a base of Trump supporters who in our exercises and I think in real life would accept that, even if the New York Times and NPR were all saying there is no evidence that that is the case. All the evidence suggests that the other candidate has won and so forth. So that narrative really tends to divide us into two Americas that are getting two sets of facts and acting on the basis of two entirely different versions of reality. And that's an enormous problem across multiple issues, not just the election, obviously. But I think that, you know, the way these scenarios played out, you know, as Larry said, Biden can call a press conference, but President Trump can send the 82nd Airborne to Portland if he wants to. You know, the the disparities in the sort of actual real life power of an incumbent who's willing to violate decades of norms and a challenger are enormous and have tremendous real world impacts. And, you know, I think we had in various scenarios, for instance, we had the Trump team, one we actually had them try to shut down the post office in order to prevent any late mail-in ballots from even reaching the vote counters in swing states. In others, we had them ordering federalized National Guard troops or National Guard troops under the control of Republican governors to seize and sequester mail-in ballots that they alleged were fraudulent in order to stop the counting. We had them using social media to publish the names and addresses and, you know, phone numbers and photos of electors and vote counters in swing states in an effort to get their supporters, you know, with also references to, you know, the Democrats want to take away your guns and destroy your Second Amendment rights, with an effort to get people to turn out at their houses and intimidate them into either acting in ways that advantage their team or simply resigning out of fear, which would cause chaos. We had both sides, the Biden team and the Trump team, trying to get their supporters out into the streets. The Biden team was trying to get nonviolent protests. The Trump team was trying to deliberately foment violence in order to create a narrative of, well, we have to send in the military, the National Guard, federal agents to suppress the protests because, look, these Antifa crazies are causing violence. So what we did see somewhat depressingly was that, you know, ruthlessness pays off, if especially if the less ruthless are not prepared for it. You know, that Team Biden in our exercises tended to be constrained by sort of ordinary norms about, well, you can't lie, you can't intimidate people, you know, you have to play by the rules. And Team Trump had, in our exercises again, this is not, you know, had no such constraints. And the result was that when you have an actor who does not say, oh, but it would be inappropriate to put troops in American cities, when you have an actor who does not say, oh, but it would be inappropriate to try to intimidate electors by publishing their home address, well, it's tough. That doesn't mean it, I should emphasize, and I'll stop here, but hope we can come back to this. That doesn't mean it's hopeless. That doesn't mean that there's anything inevitable about a victory of forces that don't care about the rule of law. But it does mean that they're, you know, the ruthless have built-in advantages.
Okay, so I want to talk for a second about, from the time that you began these tabletop exercises to now, what aspect have you actually seen borne out in reality? Okay, because, you know, you mentioned the postmaster general. Well, we have seen the postmaster general. There's been reports of a memo issued that the mail is going to get slowed down now because they're going to end overtime and things like that at the United States Postal Service. As the postmaster general would say, it's to preserve the future of the USPS. But the effect might be that delivery, mail delivery gets slowed down. So people are already being told, be sure to get your mail-in ballots in the mail weeks in advance of the deadline. I mean, Colonel Wilkerson, is what's happening in reality just on that front, for example, is focused narrowly on that. Does it echo anything that came across in these tabletop exercises?
Yes, it does. And some of the things that were dealt with elsewhere in other groups to which I belong. For example, you look at a possibility of the Postmaster General, who I must say so, is a sycophant, a person who is said indisputably wants to privatize the post office and so forth, acting in a way that helps the incumbent For example, let's say he declares an entire postal district contaminated with COVID-19 and therefore mandates that the ballots be encumbered, that they be protected, that they be kept away from anyone who might count them and thus catch the virus. So you've just taken all those ballots off the sheet, and you've done it rather swiftly, and you've done it in a way that's hard to contest except legally, and your solution might be far too late when it comes about.
Well, Colonel Wilkerson and Professor Brooks, stand by. We are talking about the Transition Integrity Project and the scenarios that a group of high-level Americans gamed through about what might happen after Election Day on November 3rd. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with two members of a group called the Transition Integrity Project. They're a group of about 80 very high-level Americans who've served in various sectors across government, the military, media, academia. They got together to game through various scenarios of what might happen if the election on November 3rd is a contested one. And if we don't have a clear result, say, a day, a week, even a month after the election. Rosa Brooks joins us. She is a professor at Georgetown Law Center, and she's the co-founder of the Transition Integrity Project. Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson is also with us as well. He served for 31 years in the United States Army, and then later on as Chief of Staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell, while Powell was at State and at the Joint Chiefs. And Wilkerson is now a professor of government and public policy at the College of William and Mary. Now, to both of you, I just want to explore a little bit more about the things that you have seen since doing these tabletop exercises. Because if I understand correctly, in almost very frequently in the gaming through these scenarios, the team, quote unquote team, that was assigned to role play the Trump campaign, they very frequently decided to contest or played through scenarios where they contested mail-in ballots or the legitimacy of mail-in ballots. That's interesting because, I mean, we've heard the president himself very recently do exactly that in reality. For example, just a couple of Sundays ago, Chris Wallace on Fox News interviewed the president, and Wallace asked the president whether he would accept the results of the November elections. And here is how the president responded.
I think mail-in voting is going to rig the election. I really do.
Are you suggesting that you might not accept the results of the election?
I have to say, look, Hillary Clinton asked me the same thing.
No, I asked you the same thing in the debate.
And you know what? She's the one that never accepted it.
I agree.
She never accepted her loss, and
but
she looks like
a
fool.
Can you give a direct answer? You will accept the election?
I have to see. Look, I have to see. No, I'm not going to just say yes. I'm not going to say no, and I didn't last time either.
President Donald Trump on Fox News a couple of Sundays ago. Now, that's clip the president. It's just riddled with some inaccuracies because obviously Hillary Clinton did officially accept the fact that she lost the Electoral College. President Trump was inaugurated in January. But Colonel Wilkerson, let me first turn to you. This issue of mail-in voting, I mean, we just heard the president there, as of 2 weeks ago, once again say he thinks it's going to rig the election. He wouldn't even answer directly if he would accept the results of the November election. That seems to be one of the things that absolutely showed up in scenario after scenario that the Transition Integrity Project played through. So if so, then what were the outcomes of the president saying that mail-in voting is not going to be legitimate?
Well, it's a very strange, if we think about where it came from, perhaps not, but a strange contestation of voting. Amber McReynolds, and I'll mention a name here, runs the program or ran the program in Colorado. Colorado, for 20 years or so, has been the model of elections and voting in the United States. There is no indication of fraud in Colorado, or if there is, it's so minuscule, it's not even worth mentioning. And Colorado has an efficient and effective system that the world, not just Washington and America, but the world recognizes as that model. So the contest that mail-in voting is apt to be fraudulent or whatever is just pure nonsense. But it's understandable because what it does is it allows, even in a COVID-19 pandemic time, more people to come out and vote. And let me say that's one insight I would throw out here. Every American, let's don't have this 40%, 50% business, which we've been doing since about World War II. Let's have 70 or 80%. Let's get every registered voter out there to vote. And what mail-in voting does is it enhances that possibility. And so that's why people are afraid of it. I've had my own fellow Republicans tell me that if there were free and fair elections in America, they would never win another election. And left hanging in the air is, therefore, we must dot, dot, dot. Well, there's some truth to that if you look at the demographics of America, how they're changing and so forth and so on. But we need people to vote, and mail-in voting is a way, it's just one way, but it's a good way to get people to vote and to get more people to vote.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I keep thinking of the fact that people do focus quite strongly on when the president says, I'll have to see if I'll accept the outcome of the November election. You know, there's also a strong line of thinking that says he says all sorts of things. It doesn't even matter. And in fact, you know what we did? We had a contested election in 2000. We had a result that wasn't accepted. We had the demands for a recount. It went all the way to the United States Supreme Court before finally George W. Bush was declared the winner of that election, and Al Gore eventually conceded. So Professor Brooks, I bring that up because, you know, once again, I return to this basic question of, are these exercises all just sort of getting people's blood pressure up for nothing? That I'm serious,
so.
Because we, you know,
really,
well, we had,
so.
Well, we had an extremely contested election in 2000. It had to essentially be decided by the United States Supreme Court. The Republic stood. So, I mean, do we have any lessons to be learned from that?
You know, as I said, I very, very much hope, you know, whoever ends up getting the most votes in November, I very, very much hope that we will look back on these exercises in January and say, boy, looks like we were all worried about nothing. It was fine. And that may very well be the case. But I do think there is much more reason to be concerned now than there was in 2000. And here's the thing. In the election of 2000, the results were fundamentally indeterminate. George W. Bush didn't end up in the White House because it was definitively proven that more people in Florida, much less more people in America, we know he did not win the popular vote like Donald Trump. The other candidate clearly won the popular vote. So it all came down to those hanging chads in Florida. And George W. Bush didn't end up in the White House because the Supreme Court went and counted and looked at the hanging chads and said, we have determined definitively that George W. Bush got more votes from the people of Florida. He won because the court stopped the counting at a certain point, just sort of said, okay, you know, enough, yes. enough. And it could have turned out the other way, right? And it was clear at that moment that either of the major party candidates, you know, either Gore or Bush had said, you know, each of us would like to be president, but we'll accept whatever the court says. And that's the end of the story. And when the court ruling went against Al Gore, there were other avenues, legal and political, that he could have pursued. I'm told by election law experts. And he didn't. He said, okay, for the sake of the nation, for the sake of stability, we need to have a president. And I will now bow out. I don't think Donald Trump is a guy who's ever likely to say that. I don't think the political climate in this country is one that encourages that kind of nonpartisan sense that the stability of the country comes first and the good of the country comes first. I think that President Trump has made it really clear, and you quoted some of his recent comments, that he does not view himself as necessarily bound even by what courts say. So I think that is what creates this sense of real peril that we have seen. We have seen from President Trump and his administration over and over a willingness, not just when it comes to their comments on you know, an effort to paint all mail-in ballots as likely fraudulent and so on, but we've seen over and over a willingness to just throw out the window the political norms that have, for better or for worse, kept things on kind of an even keel. I mean, you could argue that they favored, you know, elites, but you know, Trump does not care. He will do and has made it very clear that he will do what is politically convenient. So that, I think, is what makes us, you know, much more concerned about this election.
And Magno, okay, so let me just add that to what Rosa's just said, that in 1960, we had a similar situation, not quite as dramatic, but Richard Nixon could have very well contested John Kennedy's victory because there was pretty clear evidence of cheating in Chicago and elsewhere, too. But he didn't. And if you look at Nixon's words at the time, he had the same concern. He did not want to perturbate the country. He did not want a crisis in the country. And so he gracefully declined to do anything and conceded.
Yeah. I have one more question for both. And I'll just throw it to you, Colonel Wilkerson, and Professor Brooks, jump in if you want to answer. But I'm hearing this all in the context of the wise hope for the best, but prepare for the worst. Okay, and then I'm thinking about the fact, Colonel Wilkerson, that you said that this exercise was a bunch of 800-pound gorillas in the American leadership elite that participated in it. So I keep wondering. And now what? Those 800-pound gorillas are connected to other 800-pound gorillas who are connected to maybe some 500-pound gorillas, et cetera. My point is that I can't imagine that this exercise and the lessons learned from this exercise are going to be contained within, you know, the confines of the Transition Integrity Project. Is there really some work going on in the background here to somehow, I don't know, alert people in influential positions around the country about the possibility? I'm not saying shadowy deep state. No, that's not what I'm saying.
Yeah.
But I'm saying that if you're trying to alert people who could do something in the event that that there is a uncertain transition or an uncertain period of 11 weeks between November and January, are you getting the message to them?
I think the answer to that question is increasingly so. Yes, and let me just say, some of the things that we're putting out there, among those things, one that is very important is the media, particularly the mainstream media. They cannot act as they usually act with regard to elections. They have to play it cool on election night. They can't be declaring some state like Pennsylvania for one candidate or the other when Pennsylvania probably has thousands upon thousands of votes yet to come in and count. So the media has to get its act in order, and it has to act very differently than it normally does. Second, as I said before, citizens have to vote. Even with COVID-19, they have to vote. And we also have learned that poll workers have to be younger. And we've started a movement all across the country to train young people, and we've had really good luck with the volunteers to do so, to be poll workers, because we found out in Wisconsin, for example, poll workers are mostly over 60, and many of them didn't show up because they were afraid of COVID-19. And so Wisconsin went from about 188 polling places to about 15. That's disastrous. And we need citizens in general to be aware of some of the things we've talked about here so that they can alert their members of Congress as constituents of those members to take action or to be aware of the same thing. And lastly, let me say this to all my military friends out there. As we used to say in the chairman's office,
the military needs to stay in barracks. Simply stated, that means the military has no business taking any side in either part of this election. And I remember in 1989 when Cory Aquino in the Philippines telephoned us, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and said, I have a company that's about to take over my government. Can you help me? And we essentially made sure that company stayed in barracks. So we don't need the military interfering in any way, fashion, or form with these elections. I know that's dire. I know that's too serious, maybe, but I've read the history books.
Well, with that, we're going to have to wrap up today, because I'm going to touch on more history with Jack Beatty in just a second. But Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Magna.
And Rosa Brooks, professor at the Georgetown School of Law and co-founder of the Transition Integrity Project. Professor Brooks, thank you so very much for being with us today.
Magna, thank you for having me. And I think our biggest takeaway here is forewarned is forearmed. There's a lot that can be done between now and November to keep things from going off the rails.
Well, we're going to have links to more information about the Transition Integrity Project at onpointradio.org. And as promised, now in the last couple of minutes that we have, let me turn now to Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst. Jack, so what kind of sense do you make of what you just heard the colonel and the professor talk us through?
Well, there's an election, a presidential election, that has a precedent here, and that is 1876. Samuel Tilden, governor of New York, versus Rutherford B. Hayes, governor of Ohio. At the end of the counting in November 4th, Tilden led by one electoral vote. It looked like he would win, but there were disputed elections in three states, Florida, Louisiana, and South Carolina. Each state had its own claims, parties. The Democrats claimed we won, the Republicans, they won. There was massive voter suppression. How to settle this dispute? A commission was formed, and the commission looked into it. And it was led by a Republican Supreme Court judge who may have been under the influence of blackmail or bribery. We don't know. In any case, he awarded the states and the election. This is after weeks to Hayes. And in the meantime, shots were fired at Hayes's house in Columbus, Ohio. Rifle clubs formed in the North. Hayes or War, I mean, Tilden or War, one party sheet blared out. The sergeant of arms of the House was calling to deputize 100,000 men and have them there in the House of Representatives around Washington to deliver the vote to Tilden. Members of Congress were arming themselves. And on this went right up to the March 4th when the president was inaugurated, the nation as close to a resumption of civil war as we have ever seen. What settled it was the, quote, compromise of 1877, by which the Hayes got the election, and in return, he pulled out troops from the South, essentially leaving the blacks in the South up to the tender mercy of the racist regimes that follow it. The Negro, the nation wrote, will disappear from the field of national politics. Henceforth, the nation as a nation will have nothing more to do with him. That was the result of the compromise of 1877.
Wow. Well, Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.